with the scent of potpourri. Films will commit to memory. Crossing the felt ropes, watching from home on my TV. Looking at all my eyes can see. They tell me I view obsessively.
Hello and welcome to The Obsessive Viewer. We're a weekly podcast that reviews one or two new release titles every episode with an occasional free-for-all segment at the end that we call Potpourri. You can find more of our work, including written reviews, full episode show notes, and the complete backlog of our episodes at obsessiveviewer.com. You can also write into the show by emailing me at matt@obsessiveviewer.com. And if you'd like to support what I do here, what we do, and get access to tons and tons of exclusive episodes, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer, where you can get access to content at any of our tier levels on a recurring monthly subscription basis, or you can buy individual collections a la carte in the Patreon shop section. You'll also get notified if I decide to be weird and do a live stream of the recording, of the podcast recording, which is what I'm doing tonight. This is episode 421. I'm live streaming it on YouTube. Hello to the two people watching on YouTube, Jess and Paige, and also Clarence and Marnie, Jess's cats. So thank you guys for joining me on this episode for however long you guys are going to watch. It's fine. So you can get notified when I go live and everything. I'm going to be putting that on Patreon. So if you even just want to like get notified when it's going to go up and everything, you can just join the Patreon on the free level too. So you can just get access to that there. So anyway, this week recently on the Patreon, I reviewed Oculus, the 2013 Mike Flanagan movie. It's fantastic. It's really good. And watching it after, immediately after going through The Haunting of Hill House for Patreon was such an interesting kind of trip, because Oculus is such a precursor to a lot of the same things that Mike Flanagan would go on to basically perfect when he did The Haunting of Hill House. So that's up on Patreon at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. I'm your host, Matt Hurt, and you can find me on social media and on Letterboxd at Obsessive Viewer is my username on Letterboxd. And in our feature review this week, I'll be reviewing the new Michael Mohan film, Immaculate, starring Sydney Sweeney, which opened in theaters on March 22nd. And for my secondary review this week, I'm going to review Doug Liman's remake of Roadhouse, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, which was released on Amazon Prime on March 22nd as well. And as you guys can kind of figure, I'm riding solo on this episode. So this is going to be a fun experience, because I'm live streaming and I'm going solo. So as people kind of filter in and everything, or filter out, or if there's like, I don't know who, however many people are going to join, I don't know, but I'm going to go ahead and press on. So, like I said, I've got a pretty busy or pretty big show for you guys tonight. And before I get into the actual review, the featured review, which is of Immaculate, I do want to share some news before the reviews. And the one big piece of news that came out this week was that Late Night with the Devil, the new horror film from IFC and Shudder, that's currently in theaters and is going to be on Shudder on April 19th, that has experienced a little bit of a backlash recently, as it came out this past week or so, and that backlash is due to AI. So what happened was, I haven't seen the movie yet. I have a screener. I'm going to watch it. I might actually watch it tonight, but we're going to be covering it on the podcast in the future to coincide with its Shudder release, but I haven't seen it yet, but from what I understand, the big controversy surrounding it is that the there are these interstitials. So it's a 1970s style late night talk show found footage movie. And as part of that, they have these interstitials. I think there's like three of them in the movie that are these graphic design things that are like skeletons. It's a Halloween night late show talk show. And so in those interstitials, that piece of graphic design is AI generated. And there was a big backlash on Twitter and on the internet about it. just saying that, you know, it's taking jobs from graphic artists, and it's people are scared of AI, which I 100% understand. And I am also not a fan of the use of AI. But what I find interesting about this is that there were three images that were used that were AI photographs or AI graphic design that was used. And with those images, from what I understand, I guess the filmmaker said that they used AI generated images for that, and then they touched them up to make them look a little bit more realistic. But of course, because it's AI generated stuff, it became, you know, it's immediately figure outable. It's immediately noticeable that it's AI generated stuff. And with that AI generated thing, like with that comes the backlash, because they just went through an entire strike, the writer strike and actor strike. The heart of that was about AI generated content and AI kind of replacing real people in terms of either writing scripts or creating art or actually generating people like performing things. It's a big deal in the industry, and that strike ended like only a handful of months ago. And so I'm kind of falling under the side of kind of like, it's okay that Late Night with the Devil used AI. And the reason I say that is because this movie was an independent film that was made, it was in production like in 2022. It's before the strike, before all of that became the big sticking point of a months-long strike. And while I don't necessarily give a pass to the use of AI, to the use of like to AI artwork or anything in, you know, a film or what have you, while I don't give a pass to that, I do kind of give a little bit of a buffer room for Late Night with the Devil, because it was before all of that happened. Plus, it is an independent movie. They are very much not like, it's a different thing. It's one thing to have like a big conglomerate, like ridiculous, huge business like Disney or another huge, massive studio that has money that can be burned at either end for whatever purposes. It's one thing to have them generate AI content as a way to stiff like actual like people that work in the industry. But in this particular, very, very particular use case, in the timing of it, in addition to that, is that I think that gives it a little bit of a pass. It gives it a little bit of a pass. So I don't know. I don't know. I haven't seen the movie yet. And plus, it's just images. It's like graphic design. It's like posters. And I think that puts it into a position where it's not necessarily a gray area. It's like, it's a little bit less than that. It's like, it's not black and white. It's not gray. It's almost a non-issue. Cause I feel like if they had the resources to do that, they would have done that, or they would have gone a different route. I can't speak for the filmmakers or anything, but I do feel like it's not as controversial as the kind of headline of it said. So that is the kind of brief news that I have. I'll have a link in the show notes of the episode, which can be found at obsessiveviewer.com/OV421. Once this episode posts and everything, of course. But I'll put a link in the show notes, but I'm curious what everyone thinks. If you have thoughts on this, if you think I'm an idiot who doesn't know what he's talking about, please let me know. Preferably through email, not through a review or anything. So anyway, let me know what you think about that. Other piece of news I have, I don't have a clip or anything, but there was a new trailer released for Bad Boys 4, which is officially titled Bad Boys Ride or Die. I did not see Bad Boys for Life, which it's whatever. I didn't see Bad Boys for Life. It was like, it came out like February 2020. So it was right at the cusp of the pandemic, and I just never got around to it. I will say the trailer for Bad Boys Ride or Die looks like a lot of fun. It actually looks like a lot of fun. It's that classic kind of aesthetic of just action, chase sequences, gunfights, quippy banter between the two leads. And I'm a huge fan of at least the first Bad Boys. I remember when I was a kid, I would watch that all the time. And like, I loved it. And especially with the kind of plot surrounding that being, it's a buddy cop movie, but they both, like, the two cops are completely different from each other. One's a family man, one's a little bit of a Lothario. And they have to, through circumstances, they have to swap identities because they have to protect a witness. I don't remember the ins and outs of it, but I remember really, really liking that. And then Bad Boys 2, I wasn't sure about, but this movie looks really good. So it looks fun. It looks fun. It's going to be in theaters on June 7th. And I really think that that's all the news that I have. In the chat, Jess said, other big news, we survived a tomato yesterday, which is true. We were in the car and an umbrella was blown over the top of her car, dented the roof of her car, and then her cat Clarence refers to tornadoes as tomatoes, so that's what that is. So anyway, for more information about Jess's cats, send me an email, matt@obsessiveviewer.com. So that's all of the news that I have before the reviews for this week. I kind of soft announced this last time on the podcast, but I am actively working toward getting Anthology back up and running. Anthology is my solo podcast where I review The Twilight Zone as a first-time viewer and other classic and contemporary sci-fi anthology series. I'm hard at work getting those episodes ready to go. I'm recording an episode on Thursday, and then next week I'm recording another episode, and then I have another episode in the pipeline for that. And then after those three episodes are done, I'm going to go right into season 4 of The Twilight Zone. So look forward to that happening at some point, hopefully very, very soon. But I'm excited, and I'm excited. So I'm very excited about that. So check that out, anthologypod.com. So let's get into my reviews for the evening. Of course, if this is your first time listening, we do a featured review and a secondary review. The featured review this week is for the newly released in theaters, Immaculate, a horror film from, is it A24? I think it's A24, right? It's Neon. It's Neon. I'm sorry. So it's a Neon release, Immaculate 2024. It is currently in theaters. Of course, the way that we do this is I'm going to do a non-spoiler review and then a spoiler review, and I will delineate between the non-spoiler section and the spoiler selection with a clip from the trailer that I'll play later. But if you're listening to this after the live stream and after I have all the timestamps and everything, the timestamps are in the show notes of the episode, which can also be found at obsessiveviewer.com/OV421. So here we go. Immaculate. The premise, according to IMDb, is Cecilia, a woman of devout faith, is warmly welcomed to the picture-perfect Italian countryside, where she is offered a new role at an illustrious convent. But it becomes clear to Cecilia that her new home harbors dark and horrifying secrets. Director for this movie was Michael Mohan, and writer was Andrew Lobel. The cast includes Sydney Sweeney, Alvaro Morte, Simona Tabasco, and Benedetta Porcaroli. A little piece of information before I get into the non-spoiler review is that Sydney Sweeney, who's having a moment, as the kids say, she's very, very, she's all over the place right now. She's very popular. Recently, I saw her in Anyone But You, a rom-com with her and Glenn Powell. But it's interesting because she actually auditioned for this movie way back in 2014. So 10 years ago when she was 16 years old, she auditioned for this movie, but it never came about. The movie never got made, clearly. And so now with her rising star and her kind of status in Hollywood, she actually went ahead and produced this movie. She reached out to the writer She got the script. She revised it, hired a director. She found financiers and eventually sold the film to Neon, who released it. So she's a big time producer of this movie. So that's really interesting. And having said that, let's go in to my non-spoiler review of Immaculate. I came into this movie with some fairly positive expectations. It is, by all accounts, it is a body horror, dark religion sort of horror movie. And that's the type of horror that I'm pretty interested in. That is a type of horror that I'm pretty interested in that, to be frank, obviously my favorite writer, Stephen King, he delves with dark religion a lot dark devotion to religion, like religious fanaticism. And that's something that always like piques my interest, always just really kind of really makes me very much interested in the story that he's telling. And as such, now that I'm an adult, I am really interested in that as a subject matter in terms of a vessel for horror in fiction. And having said that, this movie is about this newly anointed nun who becomes pregnant of a virgin birth, like an immaculately conceived child. And as the premise kind of hints at, it becomes more of a dark, sinister story about, you know, what is going on in this convent, what is going on with the people in control. And on the surface, that is such an interesting platform to tell a story. Unfortunately, this movie falls very short of that. I ended up rating it 2.5 stars on Letterboxd, and I'm going to kind of work through some of my feelings about this and how it was really just kind of a big disappointment to me. And the big thing that I want to point out first is that this movie had, like, on its premise, on the face of its premise, it has a very interesting angle. The idea that a woman would immaculately conceive a child. And that is such an interesting thing because that is at the cornerstone of like religion and Christianity. And that's a big thing. That's a big part of that. And when I saw the trailers for this, I kept thinking that, man, this could be such an interesting movie if it really dives into how people respond to that, how people react to that, how this particular woman reacts to this baby that is growing inside her suddenly. Like the idea of a woman getting pregnant, like the most surprising pregnancy imaginable. That is such an interesting thing to dive into psychological horror and psychological, like the psychological horror of it and the psychological effects of that on this particular character. And then you have the outside observers of that in that the whole, like everyone at the convent, like knows that she's, you know, immaculately conceived this child, and you have the reactions to that. Like all of that is a great, great, like groundwork for a very interesting horror film. And while the movie does do some pretty interesting things, and I will say I'll dive more into it in spoilers, but the third act is really overall really satisfying to a certain extent. While that is the case, like I feel like there are some pretty hefty script issues in this movie, and there is a lot of big missteps in the movie in terms of characterization and building up the tension. So I'm going to try my best to explain these things in non-spoilers before I go into spoilers, but the spoiler section is going to be where it's at, really. So in non-spoilers, we have the introduction of Cecilia as she is going to Italy. It's established that she does not speak the language. She is from she's from just outside of Detroit, I think, in the movie. And so she only speaks English. She is there's like police at like customs or whatever in the movie. They kind of like, there's that exposition dump where they're like, well, what, you know, what brings you to Italy? And she's like, oh, you know, I'm taking my vows to be a nun. And, you know, it's something that's, something that I got to do. And like, it opens with that in a pretty satisfying way, because it sets the tone that these two men, these two like customs officers or police officers, whoever, who are detaining her until they get the actual like proof or whatever that she's going to the convent. They're kind of eyeing her up and down. They're objectifying her with their eyes. Like they linger a little too much on her looks, and then they say something to the effect of like, are you sure? Like what makes you want to be a nun? Are you sure you want to, you know, give up your youth to be a nun? Like hinting at that, you know, they're objectifying her and sexualizing her. And that is an interesting hint at what the movie could have been. And what I mean by that is that it doesn't necessarily dive into that kind of sense of femininity, bodily autonomy, feminism, anything like that. There are little bits and pieces here and there, but it doesn't create a cohesive sense of this character and what her arc is, what she's going through and what she's doing. And that's really a bummer, because I think Sydney Sweeney is a phenomenal actress. She is a phenomenal actress. And I think that there is a bunch of stuff that she can do dramatically, and she can convey with her craft, with her performance, that the script in the movie just doesn't give her. And I'll talk about that a little bit more, because there are several things about this that just bother the hell out of me. But for the most part, it just kind of hints at these themes of bodily autonomy and these themes of femininity and feminism that just, they don't go anywhere with. Instead, they hint at it, and then they dive into, basically dive into body horror and, you know, mutilation and kind of grotesque, body horror imagery, which is good. Like, it's pretty good. It's pretty disturbing. It's a graphic movie, but without that bedrock of a central characterization in the lead character, it just feels very empty and hollow. And let me talk a little bit more about the characters. And so Cecilia, she meets there are these two sisters, the two nuns at the convent. One is, I think, Sister Isabel, who is immediately antagonistic towards Cecilia. And it's kind of implied that it's because people comment on how beautiful Cecilia is, and it's a little bit of a jealousy angle from Isabel. And that maybe that's why she's just immediately contentious toward Cecilia. And then the kind of counter to that is Sister Gwen, who is this kind of rebellious young woman who is a nun, and like, she befriends Cecilia. And what I have a problem with the movie is that there isn't a very solid way that it explores these characters in any meaningful way. Instead, we get like the bare minimum. Like, the introduction of Sister Gwen is when she meets Cecilia and they're talking. They exchange like their backstories, basically. Like, Gwen is like, you know, how did you, what brought you here all the way from, you know, America? And she's like, oh, well, you know, my parish closed down just because of low attendance. And I had, it later comes to light that she has something that happened in her life as a child, and that brought her toward the idea. It was a near-death experience, I'll say that. It was a near-death experience that brought her to the thought that, I don't know why God saved me, and I'm determined to find out why he saved me and what I'm meant to do. And that led her to become a nun, which is admirable. It's good. It's solid. Solid backstory for her. But the problem is that backstory comes about specifically just to appease the kind of bare minimum of characterization. And I'll talk about that in a bit, but I want to talk about Sister Gwen's backstory, because she, like I said, she's kind of rebellious. She's kind of a, I can't remember how she describes herself, but she says that all the nuns there are either runaways or freaks or both, and then Cecilia's like, which one are you? And she's like, both. Like, there is a really good friendship between Gwen and Cecilia that would have been better if it was explored more. But when Cecilia asks Gwen what brought her to the nunnery and brought her to the nun life, she implies or very directly says that, you know, I was assaulted by a man and that brought me here. And again, that backstory is just to give like a little bit of texture in that moment. There's nothing in the way of like a character arc for these two characters. Like, Cecilia is the main character of the movie, and there's not really that big of a sense of a character arc for her. And Gwen is kind of just like, she has this big dramatic backstory, but that backstory does not equate to anything really that meaningful in terms of characterization. I'll talk in spoilers, but basically that is just a dangling thread amongst a big bunch of dangling threads in this movie. And it's really frustrating. So that's the introduction of the characters. The biggest issue that I have with this movie that I can talk about in non-spoilers is that at no point do we ever really get a sense of what Cecilia is going through mentally and emotionally. And I'm talking about immediately after she finds out that she's pregnant. She is basically interrogated by the people in charge of the convent. And she's like, no, I haven't had sex with anyone ever. And I don't know what's happening. And so, like, here, like, just in terms of the entire movie, like, the entire movie is about this woman who suddenly becomes pregnant through an immaculate conception in a convent where she is surrounded by, and she herself believes that it is God impregnating her, like Mary. Like, it is a big, big, life-altering, like, miraculous thing that's depicted in this movie. And we don't ever really get a sense of what Cecilia is going through mentally and emotionally. We do not ever really see what her deal is, what her perspective is on this. And that's something that I found so peculiar and frustrating in that this is a movie about, like I said, bodily autonomy and feminism. And like, that's the subtext of this movie. And the movie doesn't give us anything with regard to the main character's emotional struggles with this. Instead, it just becomes this body horror thing where she is experiencing, you know, pregnancy, and she's experiencing pushback from the people in the convent in charge of everything when she's like, you know, maybe I should see a real doctor. Maybe I should go to a hospital instead of being here. And like, that's all in service of like mystery elements and like what's going on in the convent, what the whole deal is. But I really found myself wanting to know more about Cecilia's experience and what she was going through, how she felt about being impregnated without doing anything to create a pregnancy. Like, this is, again, it is a life-altering, miraculous, and completely unbelievable situation that she's in, and we don't get anything in terms of her confiding in anyone about what she's going through. We don't, like, there is such a wealth of drama that could have been mined just from Sydney Sweeney in her performance and her character, in regards to, like, how does she feel about the idea of not only bringing a life into the world, but bringing a life that is immediately, like, from conception, that is not consensual or not something that she was aware of or party to or anything, like, that being perceived by everyone around her as the second coming of Christ. Like, that is such a weighty, huge, massive thing for a person to be carrying throughout the movie. And I just want to reiterate, we don't get any of that. We don't get anything about what she is going through mentally with this experience. And it is such a missed opportunity. In fact, and I'll talk about this more in spoilers, but the way that the movie's structured is that we get like one montage of Cecilia working in the convent. It's like a caregiver situation where a lot of people are brought there as like kind of a hospice situation. So it's a quick montage of her and the other nuns. Basically, there's a bunch of nuns caring after ailing women and women who are near death. And I wish that there was more to that too. Like this movie is a lean 90 minutes. And I just wish, like, I rarely say this about movies. And in fact, I don't like when people complain that like, oh, this movie was too long or too whatever. Or like they could have shaved 20 minutes off of this. I try not to really have that kind of criticism with a movie, but this movie needed an extra 15 to 20 minutes. And it is noticeable that the 15 to 20 minutes that were seemingly cut out were literally the entire first trimester. So the movie is segmented by trimesters, the trimesters of the pregnancy. And it's on the screen of like second trimester, third trimester, throughout the course of the pregnancy. And granted, maybe I missed it, but there is not a first trimester section. She finds out that she's pregnant, and then there is a smash cut to second trimester, where it's months in the future. This is how little I know about the female anatomy, but I don't know how long a trimester is for a pregnancy. But she finds out she's pregnant, and then boom, she's in the second trimester. And it's like there is an entire act of the movie that is completely omitted. And that act of the movie is that first trimester where she would have dealt with the mental and emotional ramifications of what happened and what she's going through in that first trimester. And the movie just nixes that. It is completely gone from the movie. And because it was so jarring and so annoying that happened, that I was kind of astonished, because everything else from there is body horror and mystery and reveals, and some of that stuff works pretty well and other stuff in that doesn't work that well, but all as a whole it doesn't really work because we don't have that foundation of what she is going through, what she has went through in that first trimester. Like, it's just, it's maddening to me. It is really, really annoying. But I'll probably talk more about that or more in spoilers. But basically, this movie just, like, did not work for me on an emotional level, because I don't think that there was enough with Cecilia's characterization to really make me root for her or really make me invested in her journey through the movie. And there is an argument to be made, which I'll talk again in spoilers about it, but there's an argument to be made that she begins the movie as a devout, a woman of devout faith, as the premise says. And the movie is slowly chips away at that through this experience. And that is very clearly like the intention of the movie and the intention of where the movie is leading. But again, there is not enough. There's not enough of a push and pull or tug of war aspect with her dealing with that. It is just her getting deeper and deeper into this pregnancy and realizing that, oh, the people around me are kind of messed up, and maybe this isn't the best situation to be in. And it's just really frustrating, because I feel like, again, this subject matter, this perspective, and this particular, the way that the movie examines this phenomenon, could have been so much more interesting. And I don't know anything about Andrew Lobel, and I don't know how much Sydney Sweeney like worked on this script or anything. She doesn't have like a writing credit or anything, so I would assume that it's not that much. Not that much of revising it or anything. The writer hasn't really done anything that I've seen aside from this movie, but I don't really want to paint it with this brush too much, but I do kind of really feel like maybe this movie would have benefited from a heavier rewrite specifically from a woman, because again, there is no reason. There is not a single reason that I can think of to have the entire first trimester just completely not included in the movie. Like, there is not a single reason why I can think that. This is a 90-minute movie, and I don't know if that's like a studio mandate for it to be like a, oh hey, you know, we need to keep this at 90 minutes, so let's cut out literally the portion of the movie that has the most potential for character development. So let's just get rid of that and get into the body horror stuff. But I do think that maybe there should have been another voice at the helm of the script, and another, maybe a female perspective, in the script writing phase of it to really deal, like to dive into what the mental implications of that would be on a woman, instead of just having like the body horror elements of it fleshed out through the majority of the movie. That is an overview of that. In terms of performances and overall entertainment value, I don't know. It, like, the performances were solid. Again, Sydney Sweeney isn't given as much stuff to do as she should have, especially since this is literally, like, this is a vehicle for her. She is the central character. She is the person at the center of this. She is the nun who is impregnated by God. She should have an insane role for her, but instead it is all kind of flashing of body horror and mystique surrounding the convent, which wears very thin when it's in contrast to this larger than life miraculous scenario that's played out in her womb. Like, it's really, really frustrating. And it's not even 90 minutes. It's an hour and 29 minutes. Like, I don't know. In terms of the production value, the design of it, like, the body horror aspect of it is really good. It's really well done. It's creepy. It's unsettling. There are, there's a lot of violence in it. There's some pretty gruesome stuff. I will say this, and I referenced it on Patreon when I reviewed Oculus, because there is something involving a fingernail. And I will say this, and I've said it before many times, fingernails and teeth in movies, when there is grotesque things that happen to them, grotesque things that happen to fingernails and teeth in movies, that is a limit for me. I can't deal with that in a movie. And there is one fingernail sequence in this that doesn't make sense to me outside of it just being like a, oh, we need to do a body horror moment here, so let's have this fingernail removed. And it's gross, it's disgusting, it's the one part of the movie where I looked away, and it freaked me out to no end, but it really it didn't seem like it really needed to be in there. So yeah, but the other body horror stuff is pretty solid, and it's good if you like that kind of gruesome stuff. There's one scene where it's a close-up of a mutilated face. I'll say that. And it is grotesque. It's disturbing. It's really good. And the overall aesthetic of the convent and the nunnery and the design of it, the location of it, is really, really isolating and solid. And that is a very important aspect of it, because you have this fish out of water story of Cecilia being in Italy, not knowing the language, being extraordinarily far from home, and she is alone, basically. And I really like that in contrast to the set design and the visualization of the convent, because it is creepy, it's unsettling, it is a foreign location for her. And you really get the sense that, yeah, she's isolated and alone, and it's a scary time. It's a scary thing to be in. The only issue is I wish it wasn't as brief. I wish it wasn't as, I wish it went further than just establishing it as her being isolated and alone. I wish that it would have been a little bit more detailed in terms of what, like, the location and like what, like the overall creepiness factor of the location would have been a lot better explored. Like everything else in this movie would have been a lot better if it was explored more fully. So I think that that's about as much as I can say in non-spoilers for Immaculate. Yeah, I didn't like it. I ended up rating it 2.5 stars, which I'll talk about why. I'll talk about why in spoilers I rated it 2.5 stars as opposed to 2 stars, because there are things in the third act that I actually really enjoyed and was very interested in. So let me go ahead and go into my spoiler review. So I'm going to go into my spoiler review for Immaculate. Once again, it is in theaters. It's from Neon, so I don't know when it'll be out on digital or anything, but I ended up rating it 2.5 stars, didn't like it that much. Honestly, I was fairly disappointed in it. Overall, it just didn't really work for me. So, so I'm going to go ahead and go into spoilers, check the show notes for timestamps of where you can navigate around spoilers and everything. But, I'm going to go ahead and play a clip from the trailer for Immaculate. And when I come back, I'm going to be spoiling the movie.
In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Hello? I know God saved me for a reason, but I guess I'm still searching for what that reason is.
Too much blood of Christ.
It's a miracle. You are with child.
Okay, so spoilers on for Immaculate. Once again, I'm going to be spoiling the movie from here on out, so check the show notes for timestamps, all of that good stuff. Okay, so where to begin with spoilers? There are two big things that I want to touch on in spoilers. First, before I get to that, let's talk about Sister Gwen. Again, there is not enough development of Cecilia and Gwen and their relationship, their friendship, and there isn't even enough stuff with Isabel either as the adversarial nun, because there is that lack of the first trimester. So throughout the movie, we have Isabel being antagonistic towards Cecilia, and we have Gwen being someone that she can confide in and she's bonding with. It's discovered later in the second trimester where Isabel tries to drown Cecilia and tries to kill her. And she's screaming like, it should have been me. They should have tried it on me. Like, it should have been me. It was supposed to be me. And there's a lot of like confusion around that, but it's not a lot of confusion because it kind of telegraphs like what she means, that this is not the Immaculate Conception that is being sold to everyone there. They lay it on a little bit thick. I do like the way that that's handled at the end of the movie, but I do feel like that was telegraphed a little too much. But I'll work through my feelings on that later. But Sister Isabel tries to drown her and kill her, and then it's implied that she is pushed. I don't know if it's necessary. Well, I guess it's implied that she's pushed to her death. She's killed for it. And that's the part where it's gruesome, when you see her face, because she face plants on the concrete from the roof of the convent, and it's disgusting and gross and everything. That's really cool. That's really good. That's really solid. But what happens to Sister Gwen is particularly annoying to me because of two reasons. One being that the movie goes to great lengths to, not great lengths, but it goes out of its way to introduce Gwen as someone who came to the convent after experiencing some kind of assault involving a man. That's what drew her to being a nun. And that is not paid off in any way whatsoever. Like, that is something that's established, and then it's established just to give, like, the blanket backstory for the character. And then the character herself is completely dismissed. She is frustrated because everyone is treating Cecilia in such a way. I think it's because they won't take her to the hospital. I don't know, but it's because she's frustrated with how she's being, like, the whole thing with Cecilia is being handled. She's frustrated with that, which is really interesting on the surface. Her sticking up for her friend and her trying to get, like, everyone to snap out of this weirdness. But then she's driven away. She's pulled away by the men in charge, and she's screaming, like, get off me, and everything. And then the next scene, we have Cecilia tracking her down or following her screams, and she finds her being held in, like, not dungeon, but, like, in the kind of separate part of the convent. And, like, it's a grotesque scene where Cecilia watches them pull Gwen's tongue out and cut it off. And it's disgusting. It's gruesome. And then Cecilia screams, and then she's interrupted by the other nun or one of the former ones who was attempted to be pregnant, I guess. And then we don't get any more of Gwen. Like, it's nothing. Like Cecilia doesn't try to intervene. She doesn't follow up on it. There's nothing about Gwen after that point in the movie. And it's like, what was the point of the character if there isn't any follow through on what they're showing us in the movie? And that's how I felt about Cecilia and the rest of the movie, really, is that there's just not a lot of follow through on almost any aspect of it. And I mentioned in the non-spoiler section that it seems to be making a case to be about Cecilia slowly losing faith and recognizing that there is evil lurking within religious halls and religious structures and religion as a whole, which that's a concept. An arc that I'm all for. I'm very interested in, but the movie doesn't do anything with it. It leads to a provocative and shocking ending that is completely unearned. And I'll talk about that later because I do have another thing that I want to talk about again before we get to the shocking ending, which people are praising, I think. I think people are saying that it's an incredible ending. It's fine. Like I said, it doesn't pay off anything. Like, it's not... If it was the end to a more strictly done character arc for Cecilia, I would have been all for it. But by the end of it, I was just like, okay, fine. Yeah, that's a shocking ending, but it doesn't tell me too much about the character. I'll work out my feelings here in a second on that. But before that, I do want to talk about the one thing about this movie that I really, really liked. I really enjoyed. So the kind of inciting incident is that Cecilia finds the group of nuns that are doing this ritualistic stuff in a section of the place. They have, like, this red, like, mask on. And she's given a nice piece of exposition by the Reverend Mother explaining to her that they have one of the nails from Jesus's crucifixion. Like, they actually have, like, what they say is a rusted nail from the actual crucifixion. And what happens in the third act, the third trimester, is that she is told by Father Sal, played by Alvaro Morte, which I think he did a really good job of being this very menacing, creepy this creepy man who is like the way that the film captures him as he is looking upon Cecilia. It's like it's almost lingering. It's almost like an extension of the cops at the beginning of the movie looking at her objectifyingly. But it's weird because it's like there's it's like they when he lingers on her, it is just shy of that. It is enough to give you enough like plausible deniability to think like, well, was he sexualizing her? Was he objectifying her with his eyes? Was he thinking anything, you know, creepy or sinful about her? Or is that just what the movie wants me to think or wants us to think when we watch it? So that was really good. But basically, he is kind of like a big bad of the movie. He it's revealed later that what had happened was they have been experimenting on certain women in the convent and trying to impregnate them using DNA that was pulled from that nail. And I found that to be so interesting. I thought that that was such an interesting thing that I wish the movie would have done better with, as it was with everything in the movie. But it's something that I really wish the movie would have delved into more, because it's set up as Father Sal, the way that he came to Italy to come to this place was that he used to be like a genetic biologist or something. He used to be a man of science, and then he gave that up to become devout. And for that to be set up in the first act, and then to it be revealed that he is orchestrating this situation where they're trying to manufacture the second coming of Christ by having like DNA from the nail of the crucifixion used to immaculately impregnate unsuspecting women in the nunnery, in the convent, is really interesting. That meld of faith and science is so interesting to me. And it really was satisfying that the movie doesn't have any supernatural explanation. It doesn't have any big, like Conjuring or, there's a movie that I'm thinking of specifically, like Conjuring or Hereditary. There's nothing supernatural. It's not some demonic spirit. It's not that she's pregnant with, it's not that she's pregnant with like the possibility of, the second coming of Christ or the Antichrist or the devil or anything. It's straight up like, oh, this is something that is engineered by people. So, by the way, if people are joining, I'm in spoiler territory for Immaculate. So if you don't want to be spoiled on Immaculate, then stop watching. but I really like the explanation of the pregnancy. I thought that that was really interesting. I thought that was really satisfying. I just wish that it was in a better movie. Like, I really wish it was in a better movie. And so here's the thing. Let me talk about the final scene, the big end of it or what have you. But let me actually talk about the one or two things that we get of Cecilia and her reaction to things. Like, there is this one moment where she's 5 months pregnant and she is asking, like, why haven't I been taken to a hospital yet? Why are you guys not taking me to a hospital? And they're just like, well, you know, Dr. Gallo, he's really good. He's, you know, he delivers babies all the time on Saturdays. So he's not here on Saturdays. So if you want to do something to make us take you to the hospital, you should do it on Saturday. They don't directly say that, but that's, you know, it's laying it on pretty thick. But then the thing that she does is really cool. Like, it's really creepy and unsettling. She basically kills a chicken and uses the blood to show, like, to imply that she has, that she is in the process of losing the child, with all of the blood all over the bed. Very cool, very horrifying, very scary, terrifying on an emotional level as well, because it's a horror story unto itself. And then there's also like that weird, like dark religion, zealotry thing where like the nun who is standing by after they're taking her to the hospital just breathes in the blood from the sheets. Like that got under my skin. That was very unnerving. That was very good. And it is an extension of the, you know, like the religious zealotry, the dark religion and the religious aspects of it. The scariness of it, I guess, or the dark religion aspect of it. So, that's a good thrilling moment in the movie. And so I don't really have anything to criticize about that, but, what I will say in the lead up to the big thing at the end, as much as I, there is a decent amount of just setup, toward this, and there's setup to it. Like even the kind of setup of the catacombs, I wish that there was more to that. I wish that was something that, was developed a little bit better instead of just having Isabel say like, oh yeah, the catacombs are off limits. You're not allowed in there. It's like, okay, well, we know that in the third act, she's going to go there, but whatever. But I do like the reveal or the way that Father Sal kind of becomes the kind of head villain of the movie. Like that's pretty solid. It works pretty well, and his end is pretty satisfying because like I kind of did get this like moment where I was like, okay, that's pretty awesome that she kills him with the spike or the nail from the crucifixion. Like that's solid. That's really good. And then she's covered in his blood. That's crazy. So that's all to say, good body horror stuff. It's pretty solid. But let me talk about the ending. The ending is a provocative, crazy ending that I feel like isn't earned because Cecilia isn't a completely three-dimensional character. So the end of the movie, she escapes the catacombs. She is in like the wilderness outside of the convent. She is about to escape, but she is in labor. And she just, it's like a static shot of like a single take where she is, it's just completely focused on her head, and she is breathing. She's just grunting, and she gives birth to the baby. And then she proceeds to get a giant rock, and right before the end credits, she kills the baby. She takes the rock and bursts it down on its head, and it's dead. We don't see that, but we hear it, and then credits roll. It is a pretty crazy, dare I say, punk rock ending to the movie. It is the type of ending that is meant to bring up conversation. It is meant to be a provocative ending. But like I have been saying for the last hour or so, it doesn't work for me because we're not given any insight into what that pregnancy means for her specifically. It feels very hollow. Like it just feels like we are introduced to this character as a young woman who, when she was a kid, her heart stopped beating for like 7 minutes or something, or 7 seconds, I think. 7 seconds or 7 minutes, I'm not sure. But she fell beneath the ice. She basically died and was resuscitated, and that gave her a new lease on life to think like, why did he save me? Why did God decide that I would not die in the ice? And that brought her to Italy to become a nun in this convent. Like that's all well and good, but it's also stuff that like she was drawn to it by Father Sal and the other conspirators there. In a very weird, like they have a file on her, and it's very much a, it's very much like a, like Unbreakable from Shyamalan's Unbreakable, where it's like, oh, you know, Mr. Glass's like pieces of news on it. It's like, oh, single soul survivor, and there's a soul survivor in this situation, and David Dunn survived a train derailment. He was the sole survivor. Like it's very similar to that. But basically she's brought to the convent specifically to be a test subject for that. Maybe it's because her body was able to endure being dead for a certain amount of time in that accident. I don't know. Or maybe it's to exploit a certain amount of faith that she gained from that experience. I don't know. But regardless of that, we're just not given any insight into what the pregnancy does to her faith or does to her perspective on things. We barely have enough time to have her acclimated to the nun life. We get that like one montage, and then suddenly she's pregnant, and then it's a jump to the second trimester, and then it's a jump to the third trimester, and then it's boom, I'm killing a baby with a rock. It's like, it's just not a satisfying character arc for her. And once again, I do think that there is a read of this. I think maybe the intention of the movie is to have her wrestling with her faith. Like, there's a moment earlier in the movie where she's talking to Gwen and she's like, so wait, you don't believe in God? Because she said something. I think it may have been, I don't know. I don't remember what it was. I think it was Gwen talking about how people are, you know, making her out to be making Cecilia to be like the next Mary Magdalene or whatever, or Mary Magdalene. No, Mary, the, I keep wanting to say baby Mary, Jesus. What is the word? the mother, because Mary Magdalene was the prostitute. Mary, I don't know. Anyway, Virgin Mary, Jesus Christ, literally. So the Virgin Mary. And then I think in that moment, Cecilia is like, wait, you don't believe in God? And she's like, no, yeah, I do, I guess. And it's like, I guess that's a small stepping stone toward Cecilia, like losing her faith or having this perspective shift. But I feel like the movie is positioning that end scene where she kills the baby as being like the ultimate defiance of her faith, or the ultimate kind of display of her newfound lack of faith. But again, that in and of itself is a stretch, because there's such a lack of any development of what she's going through throughout the entire movie that it's ridiculous. Like, I don't know. There's nothing like I've said before, that first trimester portion that isn't in the movie should have been in the movie to showcase how this pregnancy may have rattled her faith or may have made her question her faith. And then that could have led to the ultimate, like, okay, yeah, fuck this. I'm going to kill this baby because it is the product of evil. I don't even know if that's necessarily the point that it's making. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's about it for spoilers for Immaculate. I don't know if I really have anything else to say about it. I will say this, and this is nothing to do with this. This is an anecdote, about the movie theater experience. I was in the movie theater. It was a 12:45 screening on a Saturday or maybe Sunday. And it was funny because there was a decent number of people there, and I noticed I was in the second row from the top, and the back row had several people, and I could hear throughout the movie whispering, and it was these two young women who were sitting in the back row in the corner, and they were talking the entire movie. Like, literally, like, there was not a single moment where I was not hearing the whispers of their conversation. And for the most part, it was fine. It was out of earshot. Like, I couldn't understand. It wasn't that distracting. In fact, at one point I was tricking myself into thinking that, like, I was tricking myself into away from being mad about it and instead being like, well, maybe this is just like, maybe I can pretend that it's just whispers in the soundtrack of the movie, and that's what makes it like creepy. But no, it was just people talking throughout the movie because they have no respect for anyone around them and they're terrible people. But what I found interesting, the reason I'm bringing it up here, is that there were moments where I kind of wanted to shush them, and I kind of felt like, you know, I felt like I could have had the backing of the rest of the theater. I didn't end up doing that, but something did happen that I thought was pretty funny. There was a person seated like three seats down from me, more toward where those women were talking. And there was a moment about an hour into the movie where he just got up and left. And I was like, wow, he's missing a pretty crucial part of the movie. And I watched as he went down the steps and then sat like near the front of the move of the theater. And like, I had a moment where I was like, we can do that. Like we're allowed to just move to a different seat if someone's annoying us nearby. And so like I moved like to the end, to the other end of the row. It didn't help that much because I could still hear them talking. But the other side of that, that I thought was funny was that, the person in the seat right in front of me, in the new seat that I was in at the end of the row, I noticed that he kept looking up, up into the back where those women were sitting. And like, I could tell he was agitated with them talking. He didn't say anything. I didn't say anything. But the moment the credits rolled, the moment the lights went up, he like glared at them. He like jerked his head over and glared at them. And I could just like, I could feel like the anger in him. And I could feel like him being like, I want to see who these people are. And then nothing happened. But I thought that was just interesting. It's, I don't know. It's been a while since I've shared my annoyed theater experience on the podcast. So there's that. Yeah, I hated them. So anyway, that's my review of Immaculate. Like I said, I ended up rating it 2.5 stars on Letterboxd. Yeah, it's not that good. It's not that good. It had so much potential, but ultimately it was just wasted potential. And I just didn't, I really did not like it. So if you saw or will see Immaculate, let me know what you think of it. Let me know what you thought of it. Feel free to email me at matt@obsessiveviewer.com or follow me on all the socials at @obsessiveviewer. And now that we're done with our featured review, I'm going to go into my secondary review. But before we do that, before I do that, I am going to just take a quick moment to remind you guys that if you like the show, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review it on whatever app you use. Also follow on social media, follow or subscribe on YouTube. It really does help get the word out on the show and increase our visibility and everything. And also share it. If you see a post on Facebook or Twitter or Threads or Blue Sky or anywhere about the podcast that I post, give it a retweet or repost and help get the word out. So now I'm going to go into the secondary review. I'm going to take a quick break to cough, mute the mic and cough, and then bring us into the secondary review. All right, so let's go into the secondary review of the evening. This is going to be a probably non-spoiler review of Roadhouse, which is on Amazon Prime Video. To bring us into that, I'm going to play the little stinger that I have for it and then bring us into it with a clip from the trailer. So here we go. Secondary review of the episode.
They tell me I view obsessively.
Before we start, do you have insurance?
What?
Your coverage good? Like, you have dental?
Oh, haha.
Is there a hospital nearby? Is it, like, too far?
About, like, 25 minutes, I'd say.
I just slapped you. Are you all right?
What?
So you like to fight. You ever win?
No one ever wins a fight.
This ain't the Holiday Inn, pal.
I'm moving.
A friend of mine suggested I come talk to you.
Whew. All right. So the secondary review of the evening is of Roadhouse, the 2024 remake of the 1989 Patrick Swayze movie of the same name. The premise, according to IMDb, is ex-UFC fighter Dalton takes a job as a bouncer at a Florida Keys roadhouse only to discover that this paradise is not all it seems. Director for the movie was Doug Liman. And writers were Anthony Bagarazzi and Chuck Mondry, with story by credits for Anthony Bagarazzi, Chuck Mondry, and R. Lance Hill. And the cast includes Jake Gyllenhaal, Daniela Melchior, Conor McGregor, Billy Magnussen, Jessica Williams, and what's his name? Jesus. Post Malone. So I'm going to go ahead and just share my Letterboxd review, first of all, because I'm kind of proud of this. First of all, I rated this 1.5 stars. Actually, let me back up. Let me talk about the original Roadhouse from 1989. Yeah, I watched it for the first time before I watched the remake, and I really didn't like it. I really did not like the original Roadhouse. I ended up rating that 2 stars. On Letterboxd, I said it gets points for me for Swayze's stoic badass performance, especially in contrast to everyone else being over the top and larger than life. But my God, for as much as this is billed as a big, dumb, fun action movie, it's surprisingly slow and did little to make me care about anything happening. The brawls and action are fun, but nothing surrounding the action caught my interest. And yeah, that original Roadhouse movie just did not work for me for those reasons. I know that it carries a lot of cash among people who like trashy movies or like these types of action movies. And I think in the right context, I would have enjoyed the original Roadhouse. But watching it at home in a rush to get to the remake, I just could not tether myself to anything in the movie. It was really, really boring to me. Like even with all of the action and the quips and everything, like it has those iconic lines like pain don't hurt. And I used to fuck guys like you in prison. Like those are really good lines. Those are really surprising lines. They're also, unfortunately, lines I knew about before going into it. So any kind of luster they had in the moment were kind of lost on me because I was expecting them, but I don't know. It just felt like a very just dull movie to me. And I say that as someone who likes that type of narrative, really, with an asterisk, because I mean, it's kind of like, to be honest, it's kind of a, how to put this delicately. It is like a white trash wet dream action movie. And I don't mean that disparagingly toward any type of people or any class of people or anything, but it is very much like this trashy action movie that is fun. It's big, dumb, and fun. But for me, I just couldn't latch onto it. I didn't like it. I didn't get much enjoyment out of the original Roadhouse. Having said that, going into the remake for Roadhouse, this movie sucked. I ended up rating it 1.5 stars. Again, I'm going to do a non-spoiler review here, so don't worry about spoilers for the new Roadhouse, but it's really not good. It is, it loses any of the mystique or the energy that was noticeable in the original Roadhouse. Like the even stuff that I couldn't really tether to, I understand why people like the original Roadhouse. None of that exists in this remake. For one thing, there is such an annoying level to the visualization of the fights, of the brawls, and it's very much fast paced. I saw there was some controversy or some reaction to it for being like CGI level punches, like punches that are not choreographed in camera. It's stuff that is like the camera is sped up and there is CGI stuff to land the punches. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but it sticks out so much and it is so annoying. It really takes me out of the movie. And it's one aspect of the movie that takes me out of the movie amongst a host of things that take me out of the movie. It's not a good movie. The things that it does that do work for me pretty well, is Jake Gyllenhaal. Honestly, I think that he is pretty charismatic. He does a good job of playing that level of like stoic badass that Patrick Swayze did so well in the original Roadhouse. Like he carries on that legacy pretty well. He has this nonchalant energy and he has this just like unbothered energy to him throughout the movie that I really appreciated. I thought that was really solid. I thought that was really well done. But that is one aspect of the movie and amongst so many things that just didn't work for me. Most notably, I could not possibly care any less about the UFC backstory in this movie. So throughout the movie, let me compare it to the original Roadhouse. In the original Roadhouse, God, I can't remember his name. Jesus, Dalton. he has this thing in his past that he's trying to move past from. He's trying to get away from. In the original Roadhouse, it is that he was in a fight. He was in an altercation with someone and killed him. There is a similar backstory for Dalton in this movie, but it is done so poorly and it is so uninteresting. It doesn't involve like a one-on-one fight with someone outside of, you know, UFC fighting. It deals with like his time as a UFC fighter. And that alone could have been fine. Like, that change is not a change that I think wrecks the movie at all. What I do think wrecks the movie is that it utilizes that. Like, it communicates that to the audience through flashbacks and dream sequences. Whereas in the original Roadhouse, Dalton has like a love interest that is, I think, from his past that is consoling him and is like confiding in him, or he confides in her. And it's like, it's an actual like relationship where she is explaining that, like, you know, you couldn't have known that this would have happened, or you can move past it. Like, you had no choice and what have you. Here in this version, we just have Dalton having boat dreams because he's living on a boat and he has these nightmares because he's on rocky water. And that is the only time that we get the backstory. That is the only time that we get him dealing with the backstory, aside from like the villain confronting him about it or the villain talking to him about it to get under his skin. The romantic subplot in this movie with him and Daniela Melchiorio, Ellie, the character Ellie, that does not come up hardly at all, if at all, with her character. So they don't have that bond of him kind of opening himself up to her about that, which in turn makes the bond in the relationship between him and her feel very hollow and just not well-defined. And it's annoying. It's very annoying. The other big thing about that backstory is that in those dream sequences, it's shot in such a way that it is incoherent. It's annoying. It's a lot of like really weird, like very, very tight shots of like his face and as he's in the ring and as he's fighting. And it's just, it's very just annoying. It's something that it cuts back to that several times throughout the movie. And it wears thin. It wears itself out in the first couple of times that it happens. It's really, really, really annoying. And that is also something that's done in the fight sequences in the movie. There are these big brawls because it is Roadhouse. There are these big bar fights that feel like they feel computer generated. They feel like they're not real. I saw someone on Letterboxd, I can't remember who it was, but I will say that this is not an original thought for me, so I apologize. But they said on Letterboxd that it really seems like every scene is like, it feels like this movie is just a series of video game cutscenes, and it absolutely feels that way. Like, it absolutely feels that way, because the way that it's shot, it's so incoherent. It's so annoying to see the way that those shots are done. It's so dumb. The choreography, there's really no choreography to be found. I mean, that's not fair. It is choreographed, but it's aided by whatever the hell is going on in terms of whatever's aiding the actual fight sequences in the movie. It's just, it's so bad. It's so bad. And I was kind of proud of my Letterboxd review. I'll go ahead and read it because, you know, whatever. I think this sums up the movie pretty well. So this is my Letterboxd review for the 2024 Roadhouse, starring Jake Gyllenhaal. I put, quote, "The bar is just called the Roadhouse, and the boat Jake Gyllenhaal lives on is named The Boat. The movie tricks you into thinking this is a running joke by referencing it a couple of times, but then Conor McGregor's character Knox shows up wearing a gold chain that says Knox and a tattoo on his chest that says Knox, Knox, Knox. And that's when you realize there was no creative muscle strain anywhere in the making of this movie. It's just a big, dumb remake of a big, dumb cult classic. And that, I think, sums up the energy of the movie and how bad it is, how poorly done it is, because those things are just, they stand out so much in such a negative way. It's really, really bad. A couple of things that also worked for me in addition to Jake Gyllenhaal's performance is I do want to give a shout out, I guess, to Billy Magnussen. He plays like the bad guy of the movie who wants access to the Roadhouse, and because Dalton is in the way, he needs to get rid of Dalton and blah blah blah. There's at least one scene that is really good with him, and it feels like that scene is doing something that isn't really replicated throughout the movie, and that is he is on a yacht and he is having someone shave him, like he's a rich asshole who's getting like a private shave. And the henchmen are talking to him. It's after they've had their first altercation with Dalton. They're like all banged up, broken limbs and everything. And he's basically angry at them. And he's pissed off because he's like, oh, there's this new person that's going to screw up my plans to get the Roadhouse. So it's a great combination of sequences of events where he's on this yacht. It is, the water is rocky. Like one of the henchmen say something to the effect of, like, you know, the water is pretty bad today. Do you think you can get a shave later? And he's like, no, it's fine. And then as the waves are coming across and the yacht is rocking, he, like the guy shaving him, like keeps like accidentally cutting him. And he reacts with just pure anger at the guy shaving him. And it is a fun sequence because it's multi-layered. We have the henchmen that are licking their wounds over this new bouncer guy who's just beat the shit out of them. And then we have the guy who it's indirectly, you know, causing trouble with, or it's, you know, like he's getting stressed out thinking about the issue that's cropping up with this guy, while this other guy is trying to shave him in the most ridiculous set imaginable, with the waves crashing and with the boat rocking way too much. It's just, it's a very good comedic setup and executed really well. Unfortunately, nothing else in the movie is like that. Nothing else in the movie is done with that level of, with that level of care in terms of the storytelling. Like the closest I can say is that there's a henchman that is very much like a down-to-earth friendly guy who is basically, he'll respond instead of doing like Dalton will say something like, what, like, where's the nearest hospital? And then the guy will just straight up say like, oh yeah, it's down the road, it's about 20 miles down that way. And it's not like he's not registering it as a threat. It's just like, oh, I'm answering the question that this guy's asking me. It's very fun, and he is in the movie a considerable amount with that same shtick. It's fun. I enjoyed that. However, it is very much a Shane Black thing. It is basically like the henchman in Iron Man 3 throughout this movie, in this movie. And that feels a little bit derivative and not very unique or original. But I did like that guy's performance. I thought it was good. Here's the other big thing I'll say before kind of winding down on it is that, Conor McGregor, I don't know what the hell he's doing in this movie. It is, in terms of performance, he is going so big. He is going so over the top, so big. It is distracting. It's very bad. It's intentionally over the top. It's intentionally silly. It's intentionally just crazy, insane, like hyper aggressive, like crazy Irish person. Irish person caricature. And it works some of the time, But most of the time, it's just, it sticks out way too much. And he's like supposed to be the big bad of the movie, which he kind of is. Like, it works out that he's formidable. Like, he's a giant dude and he's able to, like, he's the one guy who's able to land punches on Jake Gyllenhaal, which, you know, whatever. But it also just, he's just so over the top and he's such a caricature that I can't really take. It's like he's in a completely different movie and it's very, very weird. It's very not confusing, but it's very annoying, really, is the best word I can use to describe that. So he doesn't really work in the movie. Yeah, I don't know. The Florida Keys setting is pretty good. It's pretty solid. The actual set design of the Roadhouse is pretty neat. It's very like kind of open seating, I guess. There's a big set piece that takes place on the water that didn't really work all that well for me. There's a funny line involving that I chuckled at, against my better judgment. Like, there's this line where basically Dalton jumps on a boat where like a little power boat, I don't know, that Conor McGregor's on, and then Conor McGregor's like, oh, look at us and have our own private octagon. And then as I'm thinking about it and about to say it out loud, it's a little cringy, but Dalton's like, who taught you about shapes? Like, it's a cheesy one-liner that kind of works. But those little bits and pieces that do work for me just doesn't work. Doesn't create a good experience for the movie overall, because like I said, the action is borderline incoherent throughout it. And it's distractingly bad. I do like, I don't even know if I would say I'd like this, but there is a certain emphasis on it being somewhat self-aware and somewhat satirical of what it is, in terms of Jake Gyllenhaal befriends a father and daughter who own a bookstore that it's like right by the bus station. And the daughter, played her character's name is Charlie, immediately like pinpoints like, oh yeah, you're like this lone guy, like you're basically the archetype of so many different Westerns. And like, it's constantly referred to, it's repeated throughout the movie that she's like, oh yeah, you're in this type of movie. And it's like, yeah, it's kind of fun. And I do like that. I like that type of story. But I don't need it. I don't need to be reminded that this is the type of story I'm watching. I just want to watch the freaking movie. So that's something. Yeah, I don't know if I really have anything else to say about the 2024 Roadhouse. Once again, I rated it 1.5 stars. I didn't like it. I didn't think it was that good. And I really, it really struggled to justify its own existence. And the incoherent nature of all of the action and the fighting really made the most interesting part of it the least interesting part in execution. It didn't work for me. So, and I say that as someone who didn't like the original Roadhouse. So if you didn't like the original Roadhouse, you probably won't like this. And if you did like the original Roadhouse, there's nothing in this Roadhouse to remind you of that Roadhouse. So it's a lose-lose situation. It's not a good movie. It's a movie that is destined to be forgotten, rightfully so. And it's so funny to me that, from what I understand, Doug Liman fought really hard to try to get this released theatrically. He felt like, from what I understand it, I think he felt like Amazon screwed him by doing it streaming only. And I've got to say, I don't know why he would fight that hard, because it's not a good movie. So all that's to say, I think Immaculate is the better movie of the two that I reviewed this week, by a very small margin. So that's Roadhouse. It's on Amazon Prime Video. Watch it if you're interested in it, but I can't recommend it. I really can't recommend it. at all. So that's Roadhouse. And yeah, so we're almost done with this episode. If you guys are in the live stream, thank you so much for watching as I do this on live stream. But to round out the episode, I'm going to do a quick potpourri section. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, the potpourri section is the section of the podcast where we wind down and just share things that we've watched lately, things that we're looking forward to, whatever we want, as long as it smells good. And as I'm the only one on this episode, I will go ahead and share a couple of things about some things that I watched recently. So first up, I'm going to do kind of a twofer. I don't know if I said this in a previous episode. I don't think I did. I recently watched The Addams Family and Addams Family Values. Both I thought were pretty solid. I feel like I may have talked about this. I don't know, maybe not. But the first one, Addams Family in 1991, when an evil doctor finds out Uncle Fester has been missing for 25 years, he introduces a fake Fester in an attempt to get the Addams Family's money. This movie didn't work quite as well as I was hoping it would. I really enjoyed the kind of tone of the movie overall. Barry Sonnenfeld, this may have been his directorial debut, because I know that he did a lot of Coen's brother, I think Coen brothers, like DP work on their movies. But this may have been his directorial debut. But the overall plot of this imposter Fester ingratiating himself into the family, it wore very thin, despite Christopher Lloyd giving a very good, fun performance in it. But I did like the overall aesthetic to it, the overall feel of kind of just very, very crazy gothic comedy, like as horror, like gothic horror as comedy. I thought that was really well done and a lot of fun to watch, despite not really being that engaged with the plot. So that was Addams Family. It's solid. I'm going to eventually work my way toward watching Wednesday on Netflix, and I'll report back on that. But I do think that in this first movie, in Addams Family, the chemistry between Angelica Houston and Raul Julia, or Julio, I think, was really good. Like, it was really fun. Just, I wasn't expecting it to be so... Raul Julia. I wasn't expecting it to be so horny, for lack of a better word. I wasn't expecting it to be so sexualized between them, and I like sexual charged. And I thought that was really fun to watch. And they had really good chemistry. And then the other thing I'm going to bring up is Addams Family Values from 2 years later, 1993, also directed by Barry Sonnenfeld. Siblings Wednesday and Pugsley Adams will stop at nothing to get rid of Pubert, the new baby boy adored by parents Gomez and Morticia. Things go from bad to worse when the new Black Widow nanny, Debbie Jelinski, launches her plan to add Fester to her collection of dead husbands. I actually enjoyed Addams Family Values more than the original Addams Family. It is a good sequel. It's a great sequel. And there is this... energy to it that is really satisfying. Like, it's an extension of that gothic comedy in the original, and it's just like amped up to the nth degree. And like, Wednesday and Pugsley get more stuff to do. Like, they have a whole subplot. I did kind of feel like the dividing of the family, having them at camp, having Fester away on his honeymoon with Joan Cusack, and having Morticia Morticia and Gomez Adams, having them kind of dealing with their stuff. Like, I felt like that was a little bit, it didn't really work so much to have them all separated, but in particular, I didn't think separating Fester from the family was the best choice in the movie, but Joan Cusack was phenomenal. Like, her performance in this movie, in Addams Family Values, was so much fun, so dark and comedic, and the way that she just kind of fits into the Addams Family without fitting into the Addams Family, if that makes sense, was really, really fun to watch. It was absolutely fun to watch. yeah, it was a blast. So I really liked Adam's Family Values. I'll watch the other Adam's Family stuff in due time. But yeah, I think that's all I've got for Potpourri. Yeah, I also shared my thoughts on Oculus on Patreon. So check that out on patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Okay, so that will just about do it for this week's episode of the Obsessive Viewer podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. And thank you to those who joined me watching on the live stream. The video for the live stream will be up on YouTube. If you're listening to this now, it's available on YouTube. Watch it and like it and share it and everything, but also listen on your podcast app. So that will do it for this episode. Once again, thank you guys so much for listening. Next week on the podcast, I am going to be reviewing Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire, which opens in theaters this week. And then for the secondary review, I really don't know what I'm going to be doing. I think maybe I'll go on to Amazon Prime and watch that movie Upgraded, mostly because I have been watching a lot of kind of dark stuff and disturbing stuff, and I kind of just want a stupid rom-com. So maybe the secondary review will be Upgraded, but we'll see. To be sure to make sure you don't miss the episode, I guess I'll say, go ahead and subscribe to the show, rate and review us, share the posts on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, all of that stuff. Links to all of this stuff is in the show notes as well, to follow us on social media and subscribe to us. Once again, thank you guys so much for listening and for joining me on the live stream. Thank you, Jess, for commenting and everything. And also Paige, thank you for joining in at, intermittently throughout the live stream. Also check out Patreon, patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Join at any of the tier levels, or just become a free member to get notified when we do live streams like this. So yeah, anyway, thank you guys so much for listening, and I'll see you next week. And now, enjoy this short clip from a recent Patreon exclusive episode. For the full episode and more Patreon exclusive content, sign up at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Even when we have like a character like Carl, played by Liev Schreiber, he is someone who, like, I found fascinating, because I really like Liev Schreiber as an actor anyway, but his role in this movie is that embodiment of that existential dread, or intellectual insecurities, rather. It's the intellectual insecurities that are all about Carl, as he is someone who I kind of get the sense that his character is someone who has insulated himself, or he has surrounded himself with a bunch of people that are like members of his girlfriend's family, people that are not like the intellectual snobs that he wants to rub shoulders with. And because of that, he's kind of taken on this faux or phony intellectualism persona. And it's not necessarily that it's phony at all, rather. Like, I should walk that back, because it's more that he doesn't quite understand himself the way that people that are more... Thank you for listening to the Obsessive Viewer podcast. This episode was produced and edited by me, Matt Hurt. If you have feedback, thoughts on our episodes, or just want to connect, you can email me at matt@obsessiveviewer.com. For more information on this show, including a full archive of our episodes and show notes, visit obsessiveviewer.com. And if you enjoyed the show, please give us a follow on social media and subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice so you never miss an episode. Also, consider rating and reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Audible to help increase our visibility and grow our community. If you want to support the show and get early access to new episodes, as well as a steady stream of exclusive episodes, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. For information on more podcasts presented by obsessiveviewer.com, visit obsessiveviewer.com/podcasts. Our theme song is A Little Mad Sometimes by As Good As It Gets. For more of their music, check them out on Spotify and at asgoodasitgetsmusic.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.